great to see so many of you toughing it out in the 4:30 session this afternoon. I'm with the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium, as was mentioned, so I'm sort of the kid who's doing her own thing on this panel, and I really welcome the opportunity to be part of this session. At the consortium, we've worked on state and local tobacco control policies and laws for a long time. And after the Tobacco Control Act was passed, there was a kind of a concern about helping state and local folks figure out how to connect with the FDA. And so that's what we do with our FDA tobacco project, and it's also what I'm going to talk about in this part of the session. I have nothing to disclose. So, as I mentioned, the consortium is a national network of legal centers and attorneys supporting tobacco control policy change. And the way we typically do that is providing legal technical assistance to tobacco control professionals and advocates around the country who are trying to use law and policy to promote health in their communities. We provide research, analysis, policy development, all kinds of services. We do not provide direct legal representation, but we do provide legal information and support to help your local work. We are funded to provide that service for free, so for those of you who are interested in getting some assistance, please feel free to contact us. So, just briefly, as Mitch already covered, the Tobacco Control Act, when it passed, it kind of operated in two ways. It implemented immediate requirements, and then it also opened the door by providing authority to the FDA Center for Tobacco Products to take additional action to restrict and regulate tobacco. So many of the standards that were set in the Act you are very familiar with, things like prohibiting flavored cigarettes except for menthol. These were huge advances in tobacco control policy that Congress implemented immediately with the passage of the Tobacco Control Act, and then created the Center for Tobacco Products to go ahead and exercise additional authority. So the Congress delegated to the FDA enormous authority to regulate sale and distribution of tobacco products, advertising and promotion, with the caveat, of course, that the First Amendment and other federal laws do limit that authority, to change warning label requirements, set tobacco product standards, require the disclosure of information, and extend existing requirements to other tobacco products in the future. I do want to just say a little bit more about the public health standard, although it was excellently explained already. But one thing I want to mention is that this is such a change from how the FDA operated before. And so part of this process of regulating tobacco products from the outsider's perspective, it seems, has involved a culture shift at the FDA, that regulating tobacco products and dealing with the tobacco industry is very unlike how the FDA's other centers have functioned with the industries that they regulate. And so that's something to keep in mind when you're considering whether you think it's necessary to provide additional information to CTP on a local tobacco control issue or situation that you're having, is that sometimes, even if folks at CTP totally understand the issue you're talking about, it is still helpful to provide additional information and examples, because CTP is operating within the larger context of the FDA, and this is a different standard than they're used to and a really different industry than what the other centers regulate. So the FDA has authority to do all kinds of things, and this is sort of our wish list. And of course, you'll notice the first two things are being addressed with the proposed deeming reg, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about in just a minute. But these are things many people in the public health community would really be excited to see the FDA take action to prohibit menthol in cigarettes and other tobacco products, to regulate nicotine levels, which it sounds like there's a lot of work underway already. Sometimes there are things that we would really love to see, and we know that there's a lot of work happening internally, and it's we're just anxious for the action to become public so we can see what's happening. There are also actions that the FDA could take that would really support what states and locals, some of the challenges folks are dealing with. And so, for example, addressing color coding or implementing systems to address illicit trade and contraband. If some of those tools were put in place at the federal level, that would really support some of the local and state tobacco control efforts that are underway. So I'm going to talk a little bit about specific actions that public health advocates can take at the local level to engage directly with the FDA. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the deeming regulation proposal as sort of an example of a lot of different ways those actions can be taken. So the first action that can be taken at the state and local level is to report violations that you see in your community to the FDA. And, of course, the FDA has so an extensive enforcement and compliance operation, and it was really exciting to see the huge numbers that were put up on an earlier slide about the efforts underway. However, they can't be everywhere at once, and you also have your own infrastructure in place in your community. And actually, in our office, we just call or email all the time to the FDA if we see something at the SA near our office. It's helpful if you document it and send a picture or something like that to explain what you're talking about. But all this kind of information coming from the communities can help the FDA think about how to adjust or improve their own compliance and enforcement efforts. I will mention a lot of violations that we've been hearing about lately involve unfounded cessation and health benefit claims about e-cigarettes. And those kinds of claims are actually should not be reported to the Center for Tobacco Products. They should be reported to the FDA Center on Drug Evaluation and Research, CDER. And because of the way that the court decided, the FDA has authority over those products. If those products are making cessation claims, they're regulated by CDER, and if they are not making health claims, they're going to be regulated by the Center for Tobacco Products. The second action that you can take is probably the one you're most familiar with, and that's to submit a comment on open docket at the FDA. So how many people in the room have submitted a comment to the FDA? Great. That's a good amount. So it's the way that this typically works is that you're reacting to either a request for information or a specific proposal from the FDA, and they have a website, www.regulations.gov, and this is just a screenshot, and you can either type in a short comment, or better yet, you can upload a lengthier comment or data or observations from your community to the FDA that are relevant to the docket that's open. And I want to mention for this, if you ever have any concerns about how to do this, you can always contact us. We're happy to help facilitate that. And then also that although it is tempting sometimes to encourage as many people as possible to type in, you should regulate e-cigarettes, sincerely, Joelle, that is probably less helpful to the FDA. I'm just guessing here, but I think it's what is often helpful is more substantial comments. If you are a researcher and you have a paper that is published that is relevant, better than just hoping that the FDA becomes aware of your paper to go ahead and upload it along with information about why you are particularly qualified to conduct that research. That is more helpful to the FDA, and it has the added benefit of putting it into the official docket on that topic, and so the FDA is required to review it, and then if the FDA's later action is challenged, it's sort of part of the official record. So you're going to ensure that the FDA sees your information, and then also ensure that the FDA can rely on it if you submit it on the docket. So sometimes the FDA does not take an action publicly that you can see on a topic you care a lot about, and the opportunity for you to take initiative is to file a citizen petition. Now, this is not to be confused with the grassroots petition. It's not a list of signatures. It's a very specific sort of way to petition a federal agency to take action that's outlined in federal regulations. And here's just a thumbnail of two citizens' petitions that we have helped coordinate with other health organizations. The one on the left is petitioning the FDA to take action on menthol and tobacco products, and the one on the right is petitioning the FDA to assert jurisdiction over other tobacco products. So the one on the right is related to the proposed deeming regulation. Well, it's the same topic as the proposed deeming regulation. We have a publication on how to submit a citizen petition. It's available on our website if you're interested, and again, we're happy to help. Another thing you can do is sometimes the FDA does not have an open docket on a topic that you're interested in or that you have timely data on, and I still encourage you to share it with the FDA. We've heard of what a large organization it is and how many folks are working all the time on issues related to tobacco product regulation, and I think what's helpful, sometimes it's a little overwhelming as members of the public health community to figure out how to penetrate the bureaucracy of a federal agency, so I encourage you to find someone at the FDA as your contact. I suggest Andre, if you don't have one yet. You're welcome, Andre. But we have several people at the FDA who we can call, who can help us find the right person at the agency if they are not the right person to share relevant information. But we want to make sure that there isn't a barrier between the research and the work happening at the state and local level and then the research and work happening at the federal level, because what they are doing can support and affect and help so much what you are doing at the local level and also vice versa. So the last one might not seem like you are doing something to engage with the FDA, but allow me to suggest that it's the most important thing you can be doing. Passing strong state and local tobacco control restrictions. And there's a lot of reasons for this, but one of them is this is the way it has been. This is where a lot of the progress and innovation has happened in tobacco control, and it's also the process is sometimes less time-consuming at the local level. The process for proposing and finalizing a federal regulation is just lengthy. It's just a very long process. And then there's often litigation. That can also be true at the state and local level, of course. But I just urge you to continue to consider how to move the ball forward and advance the conversation by passing progressive policies at the local level. The other way that this is helpful, in my opinion, to the FDA is because then you can evaluate the public health impact of those policies and provide the evaluation data to the FDA, and that can be so helpful. Sometimes the FDA, I think, is a little bit limited by the fact that if it's a new policy and hasn't been done before, it's harder to sort of support it with evidence. But if you, at the local level, are doing things like, well, let's say Chicago is restricting the sale of menthol tobacco products within 500 feet of schools. I sincerely hope there's an excellent evaluation plan once that policy has been in place for a little while, and they can measure the effect on initiation of menthol tobacco products by youth. That would be so great, and I'm sure the folks at the FDA would be really interested in hearing about that. So moving on to the deeming regulation. So the deeming regulation sort of is a topic we have engaged with the FDA on in all of these ways. We've reported violations of claims made about unregulated products to the FDA. We did file a citizen petition calling on the FDA to issue the deeming regulation when we felt it had taken a very, very long time. And then in April of this year, the FDA did propose a deeming regulation, which was very exciting. And between April and August, accepted public comments. And we joined many of you in submitting public comments to the agency. We were among the 135,000 comments that the agency is now reviewing. It's important to know that the agency, there's no time limitation on the agency to review those comments. So it's a big job, and they're working their way through it, but it will probably take them a little while. And so while it's really exciting and the potential impact is so huge, it's, again, don't stop what you're doing at the local level. While the process moves forward at the FDA. So this is somewhat covered earlier, but I wanted to mention a couple of things. The two options in the proposed deeming regulation were mostly similar, except for option two would omit, it would not assert jurisdiction over like premium cigars, the larger cigars. And the other thing that's really important to note about this is the FDA, under the Tobacco Control Act, can only regulate tobacco products that contain nicotine derived from tobacco. And as you probably know, there are e-cigarettes that make claims or maybe actually do not contain nicotine, or they claim that the nicotine they contain is not derived from tobacco. That one you should be especially skeptical of, in my opinion. Also, the claims of no nicotine, also, you should be skeptical of that as well, because some testing of those products indicate that they do contain nicotine. But I say this because even if the FDA does everything you could possibly dream of with e-cigarettes, they cannot regulate the e-cigarettes that don't contain nicotine or contain nicotine from a different source. And you might consider, if you want to restrict those other products in your community, and you have to do that yourself. The FDA can't do that. So the jurisdiction is important because there are immediate restrictions applied to these to the other tobacco products, and then the FDA has proposed to extend other restrictions to the products in the proposed deeming regulation. So along the left are some of the restrictions that would automatically apply, and these were covered a little bit earlier. The one thing I do want to mention is that the timelines on the right, there are delays proposed for a lot of these restrictions applying. So, and the delays are as of the final date, or the effective date of the final rule. And so if the rule is not effective for another 6 months and then there's not required disclosure of harmful and potentially harmful constituents for 36 months after, so another 3 years. That's kind of a long period of time, and that's something for you to be aware of. We did, in our comment to the FDA, suggest shorter timelines for some of these restrictions because they are so important, and a lot of this information that would be required to be disclosed will be helpful to you in your local communities as you're trying to regulate these products. But that said, I mention them now because if those are the effective dates in the final rule, that's something for you to be aware of and accommodate when you're doing your own local actions. The other thing to be aware of is that the FDA proposed extending some of the additional restrictions on cigarettes to other tobacco products, but not all of them. And so, for example, the minimum purchase age of 18 would apply, which is great. There are many communities that do not have a minimum purchase age yet for products like e-cigarettes, and this would just go ahead and take care of that for the country. However, there are other restrictions that were not applied through the deeming regulation. So, for example, there's no restriction on characterizing flavors. All of the gummy bear and cotton candy and those kinds of flavors in e-cigarettes would be allowed to remain. There's no restriction on self-service displays, which is another youth access issue. And these are just things for you to consider. This doesn't mean the FDA can't propose or initiate another rulemaking process to restrict these products in this way, but it's also something you might consider addressing yourselves at the local level. So these are areas of gaps and then opportunities for local action. So these are areas that the proposed deeming regulation maybe doesn't go as far as you'd like to see in your community, but you have the authority to do that. And then in some of these areas, the FDA doesn't have the authority to take action. So, for example, taxation. That is something that you can deal with that the FDA can't. Also, the FDA does not do anything with smoke-free laws. That's just outside of the agency's authority. And so that's something else for you to consider, that you can be taking these kinds of actions to build on and supplement and fill in what the FDA is doing at the federal level. We have publications really on every single policy option up here. If you're interested in pursuing any of these, please go to our website or also contact us, and we're happy to work with you to develop your local policies. I also have a lot of information on the deeming regulation, what was proposed and how it would work. That's available on our website at thepublichealthlawcenter.org. You go to this is our homepage, and then you click on that button, which is FDA Tobacco Action Center, and it'll take you here. And we have all kinds of information about what the FDA is up to and opportunities for you to connect. In addition to the kinds of things we mentioned today, sometimes there's an opening on the Tobacco Product Scientific Advisory Committee, for example, and we put that information out there, too. It's our goal to get as many folks with the local expertise and information and experience participating in the process. And this is important for a few reasons. I think sometimes when you have been working in tobacco control at the local level for a long time, you either are a little confused about how to engage with the FDA, or you're a little frustrated with how long things take. And so allow me to make a pitch here that this is just one more tool in your toolbox to promote health in your community. And I realize that everybody is really maxed out with doing your best with your local tools to promote health in your community. But when Congress passed the Tobacco Control Act, it gave us kind of a big other tool. And I encourage you to figure out ways to take what you're doing at the local level and build in a federal piece of your plan to make sure that that information gets to the FDA to support what they're doing, to push them to do what you need them to do to support what you're doing. And then I would also just mention that the tobacco industry is using every tool in this toolbox. They are filing citizen petitions, submitting public comments, suing the FDA whenever the FDA does have a final regulation. They're meeting with the FDA. They're meeting with OMB. They are very present in the process. And I say that not to criticize. I mean, they're participating in the public process. But we're the public health community. And this action is happening according to the public health standard. And it's not a spectator sport. It is not an option to sit out. So we need to figure out ways to connect what you're all doing at the local level with the FDA to make sure that the FDA is able to enact the best possible, boldest tobacco product regulation and support what you're doing. So bring your expertise to the table. We're happy to help. It's me and my colleague Desmond. I'll show you Desmond. But we work really hard and we're very available. And we want to help you connect with the folks at the FDA to improve public health in all of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Duell. And let's give another round of applause to all three of our panelists. Just like to mention that the slides from all three presentations will be available on APHA's website after the conference at the Essential Learning Portal. So go to the website and find the presentations you saw here today at that location. So at this point, I'd like to ask if there are any questions, so please feel free to ask. One in the back, and please come up. Yes, sir.
Dave Kinder from Washington State. I think you can hear me.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember when what we do now wasn't called tobacco control. It was called working on smoking and health. And I want to thank our federal colleagues for deconstructing the tobacco control universe product by product. That's certainly going to be necessary. I'm diving into a particular product. E-cigarettes can clearly serve as a gateway into or a gateway out of use of combustible tobacco. And the combustible tobacco is pretty clearly, although not 100% clearly, where the public health harm is. The observation I've made over decades is it's all about culture and marketing. It's not about the product. And if I look at e-cigarettes, I'm also old enough to remember when e-cigarettes were a new niche product sold by a little bitty company, but mostly marketed them as an alternative for smokers who wanted to quit. And in the last couple of years, what I'm seeing is those folks are still there, but there's an increasing bunch coming up through convenience stores marketing on coolness and marketing on dual use. And the cessation marketing, I love it, and the coolness and dual use marketing, I hate it. So who's doing the coolness and dual use marketing? It's the cigarette companies, plus maybe some coolness out of one company in Canada that's not a cigarette company. So I'd like to know if there's room for the FDA to say, if you make, distribute, or sell combustibles, you can't make, distribute, or sell non-combustible for e-cigs. Or if there's room for the FDA at least to say, if you're a racketeer, you can't get into the e-cig market. Because I think we need one of those in order to keep this product as a gateway out of smoking and not allow it to be too much of a gateway into smoking. Thank you.
You're really asking for political action, and we are regulators, so FDA cannot do the two things that that you're requesting. But you did a really nice job of sort of bringing to life my very static illustration of what does net impact on public health mean. The point of that slide is it's going to be some combination, and we need the regulatory science to understand the magnitude, some combination of positive impacts at a population level and negative. I think we can all agree that any initiation of any nicotine-delivering product by a kid is bad for public health. But the point that I tried to make with e-cigarettes is it really is forcing us to rethink nicotine. Before I got on the plane this morning, I heard that the word vape is like the single most popular new word. Yeah. So there is something going on with e-cigarettes. Consumers are saying something about their search for, especially currently addicted smokers who, for whatever reason, are unable or unwilling to quit, and who will continue to smoke the 15 cigarettes a day, the 20 cigarettes a day, what have you, until they, half of them will experience some off or more will experience some awful tobacco-related disease, and then half will die prematurely. So we really have to rethink nicotine. It needs to be done in a regulated framework, which is why we have put the deeming rule out. We didn't give you the regulatory history and the legal history of e-cigarettes. That's not what FDA first wanted to do. In 2008 and 2009, the agency took an enforcement action against e-cigarettes as unapproved drugs and devices. But two of the importers sued the agency, and they were successful in court. And a federal district court and a federal appeals court said, in the absence of some kind of therapeutic or treatment claim for an e-cigarette, the only way that FDA can regulate them, because of that statutory definition that we were talking about, made or derived from tobacco, the only way that FDA can regulate e-cigarettes is under the Tobacco Authority. It's a little counterintuitive since there's no tobacco in e-cigarettes, but it comes down to that second prong of the definition, made or derived from tobacco. So we have lots of questions. And I've called, in the absence of regulation, I've called the marketplace for e-cigarettes the wild, wild west. But we have to have an open mind about this. And we have to start looking at this along a continuum of risk. It's not about the nicotine so much as how is that nicotine being delivered. And in a regulated framework, I think that FDA can eventually address all aspects of the manufacturing, sale, and distribution of e-cigarettes, but not in the two ways that you proposed in your question, because those are really political actions that only elected officials could take. We cannot take those kinds of actions as regulators implementing and enforcing a statute.
Right here, sir.
Jim Curry, I'm with the Commissioned Officers Association of the U.S. Public Health Service. I work for Admiral Ashley and others. Interested in your commercials, your ads that you ran there. I'll be really fascinated to see whether they actually work. What I see in watching television is that manufacturers of all kinds of products have decided that celebrities are the way to sell their products. And I'm just wondering if celebrities can be the way to unsell products as well. And I'm thinking kids who see ball players using smokeless tobacco all the time, actors, actresses, smoking cigarettes and cigars and all that, in every movie you go to practically. You don't have to watch a kind of a genre piece like Mad Men to see that kind of thing. Are you all thinking along those lines at all?
We are. I mean, we didn't have time to go into a lot of detail with our public education campaign, but we have an entire element of the program that we call amplification. So we spend a lot of money buying ads, and the old-fashioned way of getting more value for your media buy was if you spend so much money, a network will say, well, for every 10 ads that you buy, we'll run 11 or we'll run 12. That's so 1990s. What we're doing now, and again, most of you probably haven't seen our ads on the TV shows that we are buying because we're going after at-risk, vulnerable 12 to 17-year-olds. And we're engaging them in social media. So we have what we call an amplification campaign where we are taking the celebrities that our target identifies with, musicians I've never heard of, TV shows I don't watch, the actors on the TV shows that I've never heard of, and they are doing their own messaging to our target, talking about how if they smoked, it wouldn't enable them to achieve what they've been able to achieve in their careers. In the case of one young actress on an ABC family show called, I think it's called The Fosters, we put her in a makeup chair, and a makeup artist showed her aging if she smoked and what she would look like, you know, in her late 20s or late 30s. And so that was the message. And that was a message delivered directly by the celebrity. So we think that there is an appropriate role for that. And we're doing it with musicians. We're doing it with actors and actresses. We're doing it with wrestlers and martial arts performers. And so it's an important part of what we're doing.
Catherine?
Are looking at My question to you is, you mentioned in your presentation about an acceptable number, or when you were talking about the 500,000 smokers that die, and you used the term that it's unacceptable. My question to you, what is the acceptable number of smokers to die? So those are my two quick questions.
You responded your question.
You left the good Dr. Escher with a very profound question. I'll be very interested in his answer. E-cigarettes have a potential to do good. E-cigarettes have a potential to do harm. And I think that you've rightly called out the downside of the ledger. If a technology that in isolation could help some subset of smokers transition away from the deadliest and most toxic form of nicotine delivery, I think we would say that's a good thing. But if along the way, because of the way the product looks, because of the way it's marketed, because of how kids see the product being used, it winds up renormalizing the use of the deadlier form of nicotine delivery, I think we would all agree that that's a bad thing. But we need the data. We need the evidence. So part of what we're doing is investing in the regulatory science through things like a massive longitudinal study of 46,000 teens and adults to understand over time what products they're using, why they're using them, what their perceptions of the products are, and many other pieces of research that we're investing in specifically about e-cigarettes. But you're absolutely right to call that out as one of the things in my slide about net impacts that we would say goes on the negative side of the ledger. I'll just repeat the question and the challenge to all of us. Are we prepared to, when they are regulated, because we can't do any of the public education on e-cigarettes until we actually have regulatory authority over them, but are we prepared in a regulatory environment to figure out how to regulate them in a manner that is, by our standard, appropriate for the protection of the public health, understanding that they are likely to have some combination of positive impacts at a population and individual level and negative. We need the regulatory science to better understand what those impacts are. But I know I'm repeating myself, but please, in all the important questions and the debates that we're having about electronic cigarettes, let's not lose sight of the role that nicotine does and does not play in being responsible for the premature deaths of half of all long-term users of combustible tobacco products.
All right, let me see if I can try to address what you're going at. We have a situation that is occurring in the United States right now where 480,000 people are dying prematurely from tobacco use. That is not acceptable to me. I don't think it should be acceptable to anybody. I don't know if I used the term acceptable before. If I did, I didn't intend to, but I don't have a problem with that term because that is not acceptable. That is not something we should accept and say, this is okay. We can live with that. And so the standard we have, as Mitch just said, is what is appropriate for the protection of public health? And our interpretation of what that means is it is not appropriate for the protection of public health for people to be dying prematurely from tobacco use. That is not appropriate. The decisions we make are how do we change that situation? How do we alter that so that people are not dying prematurely from tobacco use? And that is how we evaluate everything we do. So when I look at a product that comes in, if a manufacturer has a product and they say, this will just keep things the same, this is okay because this will not make anything things any worse, and I look at, is that appropriate for the detection of public health? No, it's not. It's not appropriate for the detection of public health. And so what I'm trying to do is explain how I interpret that standard. And so what I want to do is, what I want to see is I want to see evidence that it is likely that whatever action we end up taking will reduce that 480,000 premature deaths a year lower, and it will reduce the number of more morbidities that occur in tobacco product users. And so that's what we're looking for, how to do that. Leaving that the same is not appropriate. It's not acceptable either.
To make it a little more complicated, though, I showed you the slide about all of the applications that we've received for substantial equivalence. The appropriate for the protection of public health standard does not apply to our consideration of substantial equivalence applications. So let me walk you through it again because it's complicated, but you need to understand the differences. For substantial equivalence, assuming that it's an appropriate candidate for us to begin a scientific review, and sometimes we refuse to accept an application for filing because they just haven't gotten their act together appropriately. But if we accept a substantial equivalence request for the full-fledged scientific review, it's a two-step process. The first step is comparing the new product to the so-called predicate product, the product that was on the market as of February 15, 2007. The first question is a comparison of the characteristics of those two products. And we ask ourselves, are the characteristics of the new product different from the predicate product? If they are, then we proceed to step two. And you still haven't heard me say appropriate for the protection of public health, then you're not going to hear me say that because that's not the way it works. If the characteristics of the new product are different from the predicate, then we go to step two. Do those different characteristics, and this is just the terms of the statute, raise different questions of public health? That's the standard for substantial equivalence. And you heard David say, we have gotten zero new product applications, which would be reviewed under the public health standard. And the companies have chosen, in selecting their pre-market pathway, to go all in on substantial equivalence or exemption from substantial equivalence. So just understand that when we're doing the substantial equivalence reviews, it's not under the standard of appropriate for the protection of public health. Characteristics same or different. If different, do they raise different questions of public health?
I'm going to make it just a little bit more complicated because... because in actuality, all new products going on the market have that standard of appropriate protection of public health. The statute actually says, let me see if I can get it out right, it's not necessary for the company to file a new product application because the characteristics are the same or the characteristics don't raise different questions of public health, and that is how we assess it. So they are all linked together, but in a bizarre, weird way.
I'll start, and I welcome David to add on to this. Well, first of all, we're funding 37 different studies on e-cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
We're funding studies on the product themselves. We don't know what's inside these products. We don't know what's in the aerosol. We don't know what that's in the aerosol is being delivered to the user firsthand and to bystanders secondhand. So fundamental questions about the product performance, delivery, contents. And then we're funding a whole bunch of studies on behavior, patterns of use, perceptions, and ultimately, as you, with your reference to the PATH study, the population level impacts. As for gaps, I defer to David on if I think those are the right priorities. David can comment on whether there are gaps.
I agree completely with Mitch on on the question of e-cigarettes. We are very interested in that because it is a significant critical issue. If you really want to know the answer to that question, the best people to talk to are the people at NIH. You ought to talk to the TRIS people, Tobacco Research Science Program at NIH, which has been set up to as a program within NIH to evaluate and to disseminate different research programs that FDA will fund and move forward. We recently went out with a, and I can't even, you can probably explain this a lot better than I can, with a new thing on flavors. We're very concerned about flavors. That's an issue. We will continue to work through TRISP to roll out some very specific things. We have laid out, Kathy Backinger and I published a paper that had a list of research questions. I can't even now remember how many there were. There were a lot of research questions, 56 research questions. We realized that was way too many research questions because it's way too broad. And so we tried to narrow that down some and be more focused. We're also working directly with TRISP to roll out additional very much more narrow areas which have our own very specific questions we have. It's funny, the minute you do that, then people start saying, well, you didn't cover everything. And so they start asking about all kinds of other things. The reality is what we're going to do is we're going to work to roll out more of those so that we can get more focused research to try to answer questions that we need in the very near future to take actions on. So they're coming. They're coming.
We're actually over time, but I'll take one more question right quick.
First, we have to have jurisdiction over them, and then we will consider. But as you heard me say, we already have jurisdiction over smokeless tobacco, and one of the companion campaigns that we're researching, literally researching concepts and messages now, is a campaign aimed at rural youth, principally boys who are at greatest risk for taking up smokeless tobacco. But once we have regulatory authority over all the categories of products that we're proposing to bring within our reach and deeming, then we can consider how to use the resources and the tools of public education.
I am so sorry, but we have run out of time, but thank you all very much for your questions. Thank you for your attendance.